Levántese, compañero, que solo fue una batalla. La guerra la ganaremos haciendo una gran muralla.
This is a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
U.S. labor chiefs press El Salvador for killers of Teamster organizer. Gilberto Soto, a union organizer from New Jersey, was visiting his family home in Usulután in El Salvador. We suddenly heard three shots, recalled his sister Areli, who was inside. He immediately called out to my mother, saying, "Mama, they're killing me." The killing on November 5th was deeply unsettling to American labor leaders who called for an investigation. They suspect that Mr. Soto, an organizer for the Teamsters, was gunned down as part of a systematic effort to suppress union activity in El Salvador.
Teamster organizer Gilberto Soto was assassinated in El Salvador on November 5th. Based in Elizabeth, New Jersey, Soto organized port drivers, the most exploited truck drivers in the U.S., and was visiting El Salvador on behalf of the Teamsters to meet with trade union leaders and port drivers when he was killed. And now Stan Gasek, Assistant Director for International Affairs of the FL-CIO, and Burke Stansbury with the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, CISPES, talk about the assassination and what is to be done.
Stan, maybe you can begin by telling us more of the details of the tragic murder of Gilberto Soto.
A murder and assassination of any trade unionist anywhere around the world is a severe loss to all of us as an international trade union family. We have to say, when the loss comes very, very close to home, someone who was a U.S. trade union leader, I might add that Gilberto was one of the highest standing leaders of Latino descent in the Teamsters organization in New Jersey, someone who we'd all loved and had worked with very, very closely, and I had the opportunity of knowing him by observing the elections in El Salvador in March of this year. It's a very, very, very tragic loss. Gilberto was going to Usulután, El Salvador, which is where he was born, to visit his mother and visit his sister. He left on October 30th. He was planning the following week to begin work in solidarity with container drivers in El Salvador and of the Maersk shipping line, which is one of the largest shipping lines in the world and which has a very well-documented and notorious record of anti-union repression, and particularly within Central America with regard to trade union organizing efforts. Gilberto received a cell phone call shortly before 6 p.m. on November 5th, went outside of his mother's home for a little better reception. He was met by gunfire by two men. He was shot at close range. Some of the reports have indicated that there was a getaway car. There are many, many questions here. The most important point is that the authorities in El Salvador, and we would say the authorities for the U.S. government, should not, must not, abandon any search for the truth here, and they cannot. We will protest any premature hypothesis to explain this killing, and it's something which we're very, very concerned about. It could be very, very easy for the Salvadorian authorities and other interests to try to see a very, very expedited investigation, which would move on one hypothesis, when in fact other hypotheses, including an anti-union animus, a real political animus behind Gilberto's murder, may very well have occurred. We as the AFL-CIO, and we certainly know that the Teamsters and a number of other of AFL-CIO affiliates have expressed tremendous concern, and we are insisting with both the U.S. and the Salvadorian authorities that no stone be left unturned. The other point, which is so critical, is that all witnesses be granted full protection. This is a very, very critical question.
You have met with the Salvadoran ambassador, and I know that James Hoffer has, and John Sweeney, and a number of people. So what is the Salvadoran ambassador's position on the murder, and from what he's saying and what the Salvadoran government is, how thorough an investigation do you think they're going to be making into this?
Ambassador Leon has communicated to us that the Salvadoran government is going to do its utmost, that the National Civil Police are going to be conducting a full investigation, and that the Fiscal General, the Attorney General, which technically under Salvadoran law has some independence from the Salvadoran government, is going to be conducting a full investigation and will very diligently prosecute those that they would consider that there was probable cause that they were involved. But we have to see what the results are going to be. We're very concerned, however, that at least one member of the Salvadoran government, the equivalent of the Minister of Interior, the Ministro de Gobernación, Mr. Figueroa, was quoted in the Diario de Hoy in El Salvador as having said that it appeared that the real motivation on the part of the U.S. Union movement for a very zealous investigation was that we were attempting to derail CAFTA. Well, we certainly have our opposition to the CAFTA proposal as it is, but we consider this to be an absolutely outrageous and unconscionable depiction and misrepresentation of what our intentions are, of the intentions of the AFL-CIO, of the Teamsters, and of the entire U.S. labor movement. I mean, certainly our intentions are to find full justice. That's the very least that can be done for Gilberto's memory and for his family. That is our real intention.
CAFTA is the Central American Free Trade Act, which is still in progress of being advocated for by this administration. Burke Stansbury, it would be helpful if we can put in context what has been happening in terms of what certainly in the past has been an enormous problematic climate of violence in El Salvador with death squads, etc. I thought some of the most egregious offenses have subsided. So help place Gilberto Soto's murder within the context of what is happening in El Salvador now.
Gilberto was very much committed to the struggle for justice and for democracy in El Salvador and for true peace. And it was in this capacity that I got to know Gilberto personally. In addition to all of his union activism through the Teamsters, he was involved in a little bit of everything in terms of community organizing. He was a member of the FMLN political party in El Salvador, a member of their committee in New Jersey, did a lot of activism. As Stan mentioned, he was there in March for the presidential elections to monitor those elections. He participated with my organization, the Committee in Solidarity with People of El Salvador, came out to a lot of our events. He was just somebody who was a very devoted and committed and passionate activist and fought so hard for real social change to come about in El Salvador. And unfortunately, we're still a long way from seeing that happen. I'm sure most people know that El Salvador was embroiled in a civil war for 12 years that ended in 1992. There's a long history during the course of that war and before of political repression against anyone who basically organized, be them union activists, students, campesinos. So there's this long history that Gilberto's assassination certainly fits into. There has continued to be violations of the right to organize and of labor rights in general in El Salvador. Just this last year, one of the biggest events that happened shortly after the presidential elections, the right-wing ARENA government began attacking a number of the labor unions and social organizations that had supported the FMLN party in those elections. The FMLN lost, and the ARENA party was reelected to the presidency. They took advantage in sort of the lame duck period following the elections to really attack the labor movement, in specific the STIS Healthcare Workers Union, which is one of the most militant unions, one of the unions that's really fighting against this Central American Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA. At a protest, they came in with the riot police, which is something that has continued to happen at union protests and events in El Salvador over the years, and attacked the protests, led to riots, dozens of injuries. They eventually arrested the leaders of the union and a number of the unionists who were in jail for over a month, who had to resort to going on hunger strike to finally be released. And the government never charged these men with any sort of crime. They simply moved in, attacked them, arrested them, and held them in jail without charging them. So Gilberto's death and his assassination is certainly an escalation, and it seems a little out of place in terms of there hasn't been an assassination like this. You know, we look at Colombia somewhere where there's constantly unionists who are assassinated. That hasn't happened in El Salvador for a number of years, but nonetheless, it very much fits into the overall context.
And Stan, the specific campaign that Gilberto is working on in El Salvador, he was organizing port workers in the U.S., but he also is going down to El Salvador to talk to them about a Danish shipping line. If you could fill us in on what he was specifically doing in El Salvador at that time.
Now, he was very, very passionate in following through on earlier solidarity work that had been done with Central American container drivers for the Maersk Line, which some have been successfully organized, very small number, but to some degree organized, in Nicaragua and Honduras, but virtually no workers organized in El Salvador, and not without coincidence either, because certainly Maersk has pursued a policy of attempting to staunch unionism at every turn in the entire region. There had been a solidarity program which had been developed between a Danish general union, having the acronym of SID, the SID, with the Teamsters. Gilberto was going to be following through with another effort to develop real organization of the Maersk drivers. Before his death, he had been actively in communication by email, by cell phone, with the Danish Union office that had been located in El Salvador. He'd been talking actively with Maersk drivers. There's another point which is very, very important we should mention, and again, this is all circumstantial, but the coincidence of events is becoming quite ominous. Exactly 10 days after Gilberto's assassination, CEAL, which is the Center for Trade Union Solidarity and Studies, which is a labor-supported NGO, which is one of our partners, in fact, in terms of the work we're trying to do around freedom of association in Central America. Headquarters of CEAL were attacked, were ransacked on November 15th, and a number of computers were taken, and there were a number of files that were opened. This is particularly troubling to us because CEAL was also working directly with Gilberto regarding the potential of organizing the Maersk workers. That's another event, another crime, another violation, which we have demanded both of the U.S. authorities, of the U.S. Embassy, and I've spoken directly to the U.S. ambassador about that, but also the Salvadoran authorities, that be fully investigated, and that those who are responsible for the coordination and the management of CEAL, that their lives be protected as well. This whole situation may be even wider than what is than what might be suggested of the very tragic events of November 5th.
And Burke, what can our listeners do? How is CISBASE going to respond? And of course, Stan, and we have a short period of time to explore how we can be of assistance.
Well, Stan's already mentioned a number of the ways that people have been pressuring around this. The targets have been Colin Powell and the U.S. State Department, encouraging them to demand an investigation from the Salvadoran government. We're also asking that people call directly to the Salvadoran embassy in Washington, D.C., to Rene Leon, the ambassador. You can find all the information, his contact information, on the CISBASE website, www.cisbase.org. We want people to pressure all those officials, the Salvadoran government directly. And we also want to take this opportunity to get people out there organized around CAFTA, calling their congresspeople. This is an opportunity to focus in on this issue and something Gilberto himself was very passionate about, and that was stopping this free trade agreement so that alternative forms of development could come to his country.
Yes, everything Burke mentioned is really, really critical. And I would like to emphasize as well the communications to members of Congress, your representative for your particular congressional district, as well as communications to senators. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee, as I know, is looking at this very, very closely. So this is a tremendous tragedy, and we continue to be very, very distraught by it. But if I dare say, I think it is a very, very effective justice to Gilberto's memory. There can be a real struggle, which is really developed around this. That is certainly the way he would want to be remembered, is by our making precisely the kinds of efforts that Burke was talking about.
Stan Gasek, Assistant Director for International Affairs of the AFL-CIO, and Burke Stansbury, Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. Thank you.
Gran Señor, Él está donde está el pueblo, no donde el gran Señor.
And you were listening to Levántese Compañero, and that is Karen Brandao. And now we move to, well, Ken, whatever happened to flying the friendly skies? Instead, we're now talking about a nationwide strike chaos.
President Friend of the Association of Flight Attendants, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, let's take a little bit of a backward step and try to figure out why we need chaos. So why don't you talk a little bit about what's been happening with some of these airlines over the last year that has brought you to the point of chaos?
Right. Well, I mean, it's no secret that the airline industry has been suffering financially, and there are a number of airlines that have been in severe distress and have come to their employees for assistance. And we have, because we have a loyalty to our airline, and of course because we want to see it survive, we have met them at the bargaining table. We have provided millions of dollars in cost savings out of our collective bargaining agreements in order to help them survive. Now they are back again, and this time it is apparent to us that need has been replaced by greed, and we simply had to put a stop to what amounts to nothing more than a race to the bottom, trying to force airline workers, flight attendant workers in our case, force their wages and working conditions down to a Walmart level, simply an unsustainable, unlivable wage. I mean, airline workers have the right to put food on their table and a roof over their head, just as anyone else does.
Well, Pat Friend, maybe you can help us understand the industry a little bit better. What I hear is really, well, there are just too many seats and not enough passengers to fill them, and yet it would seem that post-911 there is more of a ridership. So really, what is happening? What's the skinny on the airline industry that is causing it to take back billions of dollars in wages and pensions and health benefits?
Well, there's a number of things that have happened. There's, first of all, the business plans that simply do not work in the current economic environment. There have been drastic changes brought on by technology in the way people shop and buy their tickets. Of course, the price of oil has reached a level none of us could even have imagined 3 years ago. And I think there's a big public policy issue here that has been ignored, and that is the role that the airline industry actually plays in the economics of this country. I mean, people point to the successful, financially successful airlines like Southwest, like JetBlue. They have a very, very unique business plan in that they serve only city pairs where they can be guaranteed of a revenue premium. Unlike the larger network carriers like United, U.S. Airways, Northwest, Continental American, who serve all of America, I think that this country needs to decide whether or not that is important to them, that so many more communities, which may in fact not be revenue producers for the airline, that they deserve air transportation as well, so that they can attract business to their community. I really just think it's a bigger public policy discussion that needs to take place. That, and there needs to be an acceptance, a recognition, and an acceptance that there is a cost associated with providing safe and efficient air travel across the United States, and part of that cost is providing a livable wage to the people that provide the transportation.
The way this issue has been presented in the newspapers, it's almost as if it's inevitable that pension funds have to be given up, that wages have to be slashed, that and it has to be done in a certain way. What's your feeling about the way the press has been treating this issue and about the way management's been treating you on these issues?
Well, I think it's interesting to note that once one analyst or one reporter takes a position like that, that very quickly they are joined by their peers. I think it's all part of a trend toward essentially eliminating the middle class in this country. There seems to be no recognition either on the private defined benefit plans or on the national pension scheme, our Social Security, that some sort of a guaranteed pension is not only deserving but necessary for people that have committed years of their lives to working for a company. I think it doesn't make sense to me why people would think that it's okay. Yes, it's costly, but I believe that providing a pension for long-term workers is as much a part of doing business as is paying them a livable wage. As far as how management has approached this, initially, as I said, they approached it in a really partnership sort of way, that there's a crisis, we all recognize there's a crisis, can we find a mutually acceptable solution? As they have failed to make any changes to their business plan, they now have reached the point of simply asking their employees to bankroll one failed business plan after another without regard to the ability of people to actually survive on the wages that they're proposing that we work for. A comment has been made to me that in the U.S. Airways situation in particular, where this is the third time management has come to us and said, well, that last plan didn't work, now we need a little more money from you, that essentially what they're asking the employees to do this time is to provide financing for them to make them a loan while they remain in the bankruptcy process in order to help them get out of bankruptcy. They are using the bankruptcy court as a hammer to essentially throw out years and years worth of collective bargaining and reduce our members to a level which would qualify them for government assistance.
Pat, it would also be helpful if we could look at what, I kind of think of as the Walmart of the skies, and
exactly.
That is, you know, JetBlue and AirTran and ATA. I mean, how do they function? Of course, Delta is probably one of the only non-union air traffickers. So how do we understand where they've been functioning in this, in the economics of the, the kind of Walmart of the skies?
I think the true Walmart of the skies is this is an airline called Mesa Airlines, which a lot of people may not be familiar with because they fly as so-called co-chair partners for many of the network carriers, fly under their colors, but they actually own the aircraft and provide the staff. They truly are the bottom feeders of the industry, and what we sense is that everyone else is trying to drive their costs to that level, which is what we mean when we talk about the race to the bottom. The Delta situation is interesting and unique because you're right. They only have one unionized group on the property, that's the pilots, and every other work group, including the flight attendants, are non-union, and that means that the company is free to adjust their wages, working conditions, pensions at will, and they have done so. In the past 3 years, they have converted their flight attendant defined benefit plan to a cash balance plan. They have systematically increased the employee contribution to health care while raising the deductibles and lowering the coverage. They have slashed their wages. They have made these so-called productivity changes in their contract. They've done the same thing to every other non-unionized work group, and yet they are still on the very brink of declaring bankruptcy themselves. I think that makes the point that we make, and that is that with a failed business plan, the employees could work for free, and it would not make a difference.
So what's a union to do, and what is chaos?
Well, exactly why we're having this conversation. We felt we simply had to send the message to the management and to the bankruptcy courts and to the traveling public that there's a limit here, and you've reached it. You need to moderate your demands. You need to come to the table in a spirit of cooperation and talk about changes that still provide a livable wage. Chaos is an intermittent strike strategy that we developed about 12 years ago. It has been so effective that we, in fact, have trademarked it. And what it means is that when we call a strike, whether it's at one airline or, in this case, a national intermittent strike, that we essentially take control of the schedule. We target flights, we target hubs, if you will, cities. We may target days or weekends, but we decide essentially what flights will go and what flights won't.
Pat, so what it seems is that while those of us who are consumers are kind of eagerly lapping up the low flights, the low-cost flights, you're saying that if we want people to be paid a decent wage, et cetera, that is something that the consumer is also going to have to give on. And I also wanted to address the issue that there is such a multiplicity of unions within the airline field. And what about the consolidation of a number of those different unions? There's, you know, the flight attendants, and there's seven other unions representing ticket agents and machinists and air traffic controllers and baggage handlers. Should they all come together to strengthen their overall position?
Right. Well, let me just comment first on the consumer issue. And yes, you're absolutely right. What we are saying is that the kinds of fares you're seeing available now in this environment are simply unsustainable. And you know, the consumer is simply going to have to recognize that the kind of air service that they have been accustomed to is not free, and it's not $10 a segment. It's not even, it's not even $39 a segment, because, first of all, you have to put fuel in the airplane. So, yes, you're right. There has to be some recognition from the consumer. Now, the question of the multiplicity of unions, interestingly enough, there are not that many aviation unions. We initially were craft-based unions, which means a union grew up around a particular craft, the flight attendant union, the pilot union, the mechanics union, the air traffic control union. But you are right in that, and particularly I'll speak to my work group, is that we are splintered among far too many different unions. My union in particular has as its primary goal to unite all flight attendants under one union, because we do believe that that gives us increased bargaining power within our industry. And we will work toward that goal from now until forever. We are, of course, constrained by protection against rating within the AFL-CIO unions. But I absolutely agree with you that we need to unite at least all craft workers within one union, so that we have the maximum leverage and the loudest voice.
Well, we're going to have to follow up on this, but I just wanted to ask a quick question. Mm-hmm. What has been the reaction of other flight attendant unions outside of your own and other mm-hmm. unions? Very quickly, because we have had
an immediate and public declaration of support from the union that represents the American Airlines flight attendants, and the one that represents the Southwest flight attendants. We're still waiting for a response from the Northwest Flight Attendant Union and the Continental Flight Attendant Union.
And how can our listeners be supportive of their sisters and brothers in the airlines?
Well, I think it's hard to underestimate how important and how much we value having our customers simply say to us, I understand and I sympathize with what's happening to you, and I appreciate the fact that you are still here doing your job and smiling at me, considering all the pressure that you're under. That's something that small makes an incredible difference.
Well, Pat Friend, we'll have to pay a great deal more attention in the weeks and months that come as to what happens to the health benefits and the pensions and the wages of our sisters and brothers in the airline industry. And we have been speaking with Pat Friend, the Association of Flight Attendants International President. Do remember the workers who create the wealth within the society. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
And this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report.
We are one, where the earth touches sky. We are four.